Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile.
With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Hello and welcome to Nothing Concrete, the Barbican podcast. I'm Ben Eshmaid, and this week we revisit perhaps my all-time favourite interview for the Barbican. I'm not sure I ever thought I'd find myself on a taxi ride and musical journey with one of the most fascinating modern composers, Philip Glass. But that's what happened back in late 2012.
I found out that Marty didn't mind my being around. In fact, when I was in the editing room, which is almost every day, he would launch into discussions about film and film history, and we were looking at a part of the film, and he said, okay, this is going to have to go. And I said, oh, Marty, that's one of my favorite pieces in the movie. He said, in every film, you will have to take the scene you like best and cut it out.
The composer there talking about having to kill your darlings, cutting out the things you most love, with Marty, also known as Martin Scorsese. Philip Glass is arguably one of the most influential composers of the 20th and 21st century. His music can be heard everywhere, from a grand opera house to all manner and sizes of concert halls. From the 12-inch vinyl of dance music to adverts or underscoring the drama of film, such as his breakthrough score to The Truman Show.
Mike, the big news is that Meryl will be leaving Truman in an upcoming episode, and a new romantic interest will be introduced.
Uh-huh.
I'm determined the television's first on-air conception will still take place.
Well, another television milestone straight ahead. You heard it here first. It has been a singular honor and a pleasure, sir. Christoph, thank you.
Thank you, Mike.
He reached the age of 75 in 2012, and at the time of this interview was just bringing his groundbreaking opera, Einstein on the Beach, to the Barbican Theatre. On December the 14th of that year, he produced a live music screening of his 1982 score to the film Koi and a Scotsy, and on the following night, a birthday concert at the Union Chapel in Islington, playing with his ensemble. So I managed to catch up with the composer, no mean task for someone who never stops working, on a short taxi ride across London. This was made a little more poignant as Philip Glass spent the late 60s and early 70s working as a New York taxi driver.
You're at the moment, you're just coming up to the performance at the Barbican of Einstein on the Beach. How's it going?
Well, every time we go into a theatre, we have to make adjustments. Einstein is kind of a very idealized piece that will look a little different from place to place, but it always is the same. It's a very demanding piece in the best of circumstances, and the circumstances are helped a lot when everybody is trying to make it happen and make it work. So I'm feeling very good about it. I've been twice in this theater, and it's for me personally, when I walked in the theater, and I had a memory of it, but I didn't have the physical memory of it that I had when I walked in. I saw it, I said, oh, I know this place. And I remembered particular images from other works that I had here and how they looked there. And from the point of view of the audience, it's a beautiful theater.
You've got a busy year this year. It's your 75th year. What are you up to? Are you just travelling around the world and performing?
Oh yes, I'm doing that too. But I'm also, for a long time, I've made a practice of writing when I'm traveling. I find it a very good place. I find hotels, and like in here at the Barbican, I've asked for a dressing room with a piano, and I've got one. So I get up in the morning, have breakfast, and I go to my studio. And then I can leave and see whatever rehearsals are taking place and so forth. And so I'm also writing music this year. And there are several big projects. One, of course, is going to be coming to the ENO. That'll be The Perfect American. That's the opera about the death of Walt Disney. So I'm writing that. Actually, part of it is being written here. And I'm doing some other pieces. But my regular writing schedule pretty much is intact. And I have the traveling with the ensemble, playing with them, doing solo concerts and also duet concerts with other musicians, and then doing the birthday party stuff. That's what we're doing.
What's your kind of feeling on looking back?
The library that the ensemble uses, the active part of the library, goes back to 1969. There's a piece from 70 to 74, music in 12 parts. We do that regularly. So music from the 70s, 80s, 90s is played in a routine way. I don't restrict myself to just new pieces. I try to do new pieces on programs, but there may be only one or two new pieces. And so I'm always reviewing the old music. I'm playing it, and we're learning to play it, I think, better than we used to. I think the performance practices of this music took some time to settle down to. And right at this point now, for example, Einstein, the ensemble plays extremely well. Now, this is work which we've been rehearsing and playing since 1975, so and many of them are the same players, but we didn't play it nearly as well 35 years ago, 40 years ago. And no, we're playing it much better now. So that there are several aspects of keeping a lifetime of music alive and available. It means that we're constantly going back and playing it. Our approach to it is changing as new music comes up. Another thing, I'm very much involved with the technological world in terms of, this is music where sounds are programmed for synthesizers, and the actual sound packages that are put together for playing the music, that's also changing. So that we're just now, in fact, going through a whole revision of how the music is prepared for technically. We have two systems right now, one for the Einstein touring, and we have another system for concerts, and we're trying to get down to one system. It's not that easy, actually. Besides that, I'm doing concerts that may include, like if I'm doing violin piano concerts, it's very common these days to amplify almost everything, even if it's only an ambient kind of what they call reinforcement. It's very common to do that. People are used to it. Basically, working with this ensemble in the way that I do, I've been constantly, over the years, I've never been very far away from the early work, and it's been brought up to the technical levels of what we're doing today. How do I feel about, to get back to your question, I feel very fortunate to be able to do it.
Thank you.
One thing you were sort of mentioning there, and I think shouldn't be taken for granted as well, is that you're one of the composers who obviously has that very near connection to his work, in the sense that you're always performing it or being part of it. Even if you're handing it over to other people, you've still got that personal connection.
Well, I do, and this partly because I'm also the publisher, so that the actual use of the music goes through me as well. There's not a third party that does things that I don't know about, which can often happen to composers. Friends of mine who have publication arrangements with other persons, other companies, they may not be able to freely comment, intervene with public performances because it's not in their hands anymore. That's just not the case with me. I'm able to do that. That also means that when an opera is being produced, I can expect to hear singers. I'm expected to, and I expect to. I have one of the agreements, one of my publishing agreements, is that I have 2 tickets for every performance of everything every night. Not that I can go, of course I can't go, but if I want to go, there's no problem of that kind. And I have an active relationship with companies, like with Barbican, I work with Pomegranate Arts. I'm also here and available, as you see.
One other thing that I find quite fascinating is the fact that you've got Orange Mountain Music, which is a record label which is dedicated to releasing your music. So not only do you publish it, but there's a specific record company for that purpose.
Yes, and not only that, we're actually able to go back and we can either buy back or make arrangements to republish other recordings that other companies have had and maybe don't produce anymore. Some companies that have, very often records can be dropped from a catalog. My records, whenever possible, I reacquire them. So that the company is only 10 years old now, but we have 75 titles. We do about 10 a year, and in fact, we're a year behind. We're preparing more records than we're actually able to produce in any 1 year. So this is an interesting body of work all by itself, because these are recorded performances that were made, not all by me, but sometimes by other people. Sometimes I heard there was a young group from Iceland, and they sent me a recording of Music with Changing Parts, which I had agreed I'd let them do. And it was so good that we called them up and asked them if we could put out the record. And we did.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems. But getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Thank you. So it's not always just me. Or very strange things happen. I'm usually very open to having arrangements done because I'm very used to seeing it done to other composers, whether it's from Bach to Debussy, everybody. There are arrangements of all kinds of music. And maybe during the lifetime of the composer, it might not happen very much. But as soon as the music is available, people begin to make arrangements. So I, instead of putting a moratorium on it, when people ask to do arrangements, I always agree. It doesn't mean that the arrangements are guaranteed to be good, but the good ones will survive, and the ones that aren't so good won't survive anyway. But we got a very curious request from a steel band to play, to make a recording of the Etudes for piano. And in principle, I agree that they could do it, but I was a little alarmed by the idea. But in the end, I decided the principle had to be held. So I gave them the permission to record it, and then they sent me a recording. It was done by my own company, and I didn't listen to it for months. It was sitting on my desk, and I said, finally, I put it on and listened to it, and it's really good. It was really, I said, oh my God, this is really, it doesn't sound like piano music at all. It sounds like steel drum music. I mean, it's got definitely an island sound to it. I mean, you can't miss it. So funny things can happen like that. There's a harpist or a flutist who wants to do a violin concerto and they make arrangements. And, you know, I find there's no harm done in any of that. I'm not at all a purist with anybody's work, let alone my own. The currency of music to me can travel easily from place to place and from musical perspectives from one to another. We've seen that. The music of Bach is all around us in every form that you can imagine. It's not hurt his reputation.
We're talking about having your own record label, but you grew up in, your dad had a record shop, so...
Yes. Well, that happened very early, but I also was I was at music school before. I ended up working for my dad, but I also was in music school when I was 8 or 9 years old. I didn't start actually working in the store till I was 12. They considered that my brother and I would be too young to have been there before that. But we were working from the age of 12, and by the age of 15, I was a record buyer. I was the classical record buyer for the store, and I made some terrible mistakes. But my dad, he was very kind about it. He let me find my way, and... sometimes my enthusiasms misled me in certain ways. I remember the famous story of the Schoenberg Quartets that were all recorded by the Juilliard Quartet in the early 50s. And they came out as a box set on CBS, as I remember. And I was so thrilled to see that in the catalog. I ordered 6 sets of them. Now, this is Baltimore, which isn't a big town anyway, and not many followers of Schoenberg at that time were in Baltimore. And when the records turned up at the store 2 weeks later, that was always a great moment, because you see, when you order the records, you never saw the covers. You know, it was just the name, but we always wanted to see what it looked like, and we read the copy on the back of the records and all that. My dad and myself and my brother, those were great treats for us. So the day came, and the Schoenbergs, we called them the Schoenbergs because they became a big liability. Well, the Schoenbergs showed up one day. Father said, my God, he said, what did you do? I said, these are, I said, Ben, we used to call my father by his name. I said, Ben, these are masterpieces of 20th century music. I said, these are really important pieces. And my father nodded. He said, okay, I'll tell you what. I'll keep them. I'll put them in the shelf here. And when you've sold the last one, tell me. I was about 15 at the time. And I think it was around 19. It was 5 years later. I had gone to university. I was now at Juilliard. And I would come down to Baltimore now and then. And whenever I was in there, I would go and look at this, see how the Schoenbergs were doing. And finally, they were gone. And I was very excited. I was a bit older than I said, Ben, guess what? The Schoenbergs are gone. And he said, yep. He said, they're gone. He said, and did you learn the lesson? And I said, what's the lesson? The lesson was, he said, I can sell anything if I have enough time. Of course, the other lesson was is that for 5 years, that space was taken up. He was paying rent for records that he couldn't sell. But he finally sold them. Anyway, so a lot of funny things happened in the store. My brother and I, at one point, in one summer when we were very young, to keep us off the streets, as it were, we were given a storefront, and we were given our own records and a record player. And we spent the summer mostly listening to music and maybe selling a few records here and there, mostly R&B. I got to know the classical repertoire very well, long before I really played it, though I was a flutist and later a pianist, but a lot of that music I really wouldn't have known if I hadn't been in there. And not only that, but I knew who the great interpreters were. I knew all the conductors and what they were good at, and I understood the power of interpretation from going from one to the other. They were all there. I could listen to everything. But another important thing that I saw for sure every day that I was working in the store, and there were a lot of days until I finally was gone and off to school and living in other cities, a very simple thing would happen. Someone would come to the counter, they would give my father $5 and give them a record. By the way, it was $5. In other words, the prices of records, and we're talking about 50 years ago. It's virtually the same. If you go by the normal way things go, those records would be selling for $50 a day, not 8 or 9 or 10 or 12. Anyway, I always thought the music business was a very interesting business. So I started my own first record company when I was 30. I had a second one maybe 10 years later, and then this is the third one I'm on right now. I knew how to start a record company. I knew everything about it. I knew how to make the covers. I knew how to number everything. At the same time that I was at the Peabody learning to play flute and theory and percussion and then piano, and I was also at the store working in the music business. I remember years and years later, I was talking to Ornette Coleman about, I don't know what you're talking about. We knew each other. We've known each other a long time. And one day he said to me, he said, don't forget, Philip, the music world and the music business are not the same thing. Of course, I knew that. I had the feeling that he discovered it, but I knew it in a different way.
I'm interested to pick up on that and maybe go a little bit further. I think a lot of people have come to know your music through film. Everything from The Truman Show to Candyman to I think a big important one for me, and I know a lot of the people, was The Hours. Is that something that you've enjoyed?
Yes, very much so. We have to remember that the popular art form of the 19th century was opera. The popular art form of the 20th century was film. They share a lot of things. One is that, I began as an opera composer and didn't take up film writing until I was in my 50s. I began writing symphonies about the same time. I was writing operas when I was in my 30s. So I had a long background of that. I would say that I always saw film as a popular art form, but I thought the opera was a popular art form too. And again, you can see, as what I've been telling you, I never thought anything was wrong with it. I thought that was just fine. Then I wrote pieces that I knew some were more difficult than others, and some would be popular and some wouldn't be. For me, it was always, the issue was mostly about quality. It wasn't about genre. You know, that it's still possible to write a beautiful film score and to make a beautiful film, even though it's a more crass commercial enterprise, is hard to imagine than filmmaking. It's really sometimes right in the gutter. I mean, at the same time, in that environment, you can still do beautiful work. It's partly discipline and luck and perseverance, and it can be discouraging. And sometimes, but I remember talking to Martin Scorsese about this once. He said an unforgettable thing to me. He said, he was editing the film, and I was working with him and Thelma Schumacher at the time. I was writing the score. I had written a lot of it already, but I found out that Marty didn't mind my being around. In fact, when I was in the editing room, which is almost every day, he would launch into discussions about film and film history. And as we, you know, he's one of the great film historians. He knows everything about film. We were looking at a part of the film, and he said, okay, this is going to have to go. And I said, oh, Marty, that's one of my favorite pieces in the movie. He said, in every film, you will have to take the scene you like best and cut it out. It will end up on the floor. That, he said that as a simple fact. And that is a different kind of discipline than I was used to. I had never heard that before. He was used to it. And filmmakers do work that way. I learned a lot from Marty. I've learned a lot from film people. I learned a lot from... the other person I learned a lot from was Woody Allen. I did a film with him, too. The more experienced the filmmaker, the older they are, the more films they've made, the easier it is to work with them because they're so sure of themselves. The young ones who are on their first or second film, they're so insecure, they simply torture everybody in sight. You know, when they know what they're doing, they'll leave you alone, and you can do your best work then.
Scorsese. Is that an important film for you?
Oh, yes. Let's put it this way. I did the film. When Doc Godfrey and I made the movie, I had no idea if anybody would ever see it. By luck and chance and good luck, I would guess, Francis Coppola saw the film, and he said he would like to help us, and he put his name on it. It says, Francis Ford Coppola presents. Scorsese, that's actually what he did. Didn't do anything else. That's all he had to do. On the basis of that, it went to the New York Film Festival, and became overnight a kind of a sensation. About 3 months after that, and it opened the New York Film Festival, I think in 1981, at the Radio City Music Hall, which is a 5,000 seat theater, and it was filmed. 2 or 3 months later, I got a call from Godfrey and said, by the way, Kanye Scorsese is going to be broadcast tonight on PBS, that's our public television. And I said, oh, well, what does that mean? He said, it means that probably 6 million people will see it tonight. Well, I almost fainted. I mean, that's a number, 6 million, that anyone in the business of concert music is not even able to comprehend. I mean, all the people who would ever hear any of my music in any concerts for the rest of my life would never come close to that number. And it was going to happen in one night. And that's when I understood, oh, this is a popular art form. This means that it goes out everywhere. It's not a question of peeping of a selective audience. And what was it important to me? It was very important. I didn't write the music for that reason. I didn't even know about it. It happened to connect to people in that way. Partly, I think, because of The vision that Godfrey has is so it's a unique and profound and most expansive one. I had the good fortune to work with him, and the music seemed to work with the movie, and it's become part of the film. I mean, that's just the way it is. They're tied together forever, as far as I can tell.
Have you got anything that you want for your 75th birthday? What is there any present that you could get?
I'd like a few days off.
One of the most magical but surreal interviews I've had the pleasure of capturing for this podcast. I hope you enjoyed that brief but satisfying glimpse and journey into the composer's life around his 75th birthday. I'm Ben Eshmaid. Thanks for listening to this archive edition of Nothing Concrete, the Barbican podcast. The series is here to inspire more people to discover and love the arts with weekly episodes of archive finds and themed series. Subscribe to Nothing Concrete on Acast, Spotify, or wherever you find your podcasts. And if you can, leave us a review to help us get the word out.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.